KKCR Honolulu, KAQA Kilauea, 90.9 Honolulu, 91.9 on all other shores, except on Ahola and Molokai, you can tune in at 92.7.
The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its management, staff, or underwriters.
This program is supported in part by McPhee Property Maintenance Solutions.
Ian and Jonathan McPhee, Property Maintenance Solutions, providing Kauai's North Shore a chemical and pesticide-free alternative. Ian and Jonathan McPhee, both proud supporters of KKCR. 651-5412.
Mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. This is out of the box. We're going to get our ducks in a row here. Please enjoy Beethoven's Tempest Sonata. I only have the third movement.
Welcome to Out of the Box, a weekly public affairs program on KKCR. I'm Katie Rose. Every other week, we focus on the nuts and bolts of social change through collective action. This program seeks to be a useful cookbook for our mutually assured liberation. Thank you for joining us today. Today, we have a couple of guests lined up. Lena Sullivan will join us from Kahana Valley on Oahu to give us the background and updates on the struggle of several Native Hawaiian families being threatened with eviction from their homes. But first, we're joined by Patrick Rainsborough of the Smart Meme Project. He's going to discuss his insightful essay titled Decolonizing the Revolutionary Imagination, which seeks to, quote, incite deeper conversations about strategies for movement building movements for a more just and sane world, end quote. Patrick Rainsborough is a veteran organizer who co-founded the Smart Meme Strategy and Training Project in 2002, which provides grassroots partners with support on strategy, messaging, and capacity building. Patrick was previously the organizing director of the Rainforest Action Network. And during the course of the program, we will open the phones for your comments, questions, and ideas. So let's welcome Patrick. Hi, Patrick.
Hello there.
I'm glad you could join us. Are you calling from San Francisco, I assume?
I am, and it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to have you actually in the studio at some point in the future. Patrick, we're going to be discussing your essay, Decolonizing the Revolutionary Imagination, in a moment. But I wanted to first ask you what the Smart Meme Project is. Can you fill us in a little bit on that?
Sure. So the Smart Meme Project is a sort of movement support and strategy center. We're a national collective of organizers, trainers, strategists, communications professionals who are all focused on building a culture of strategy within grassroots movements in the United States. So we're essentially a nonprofit organization working to support more effective movement building in the current context.
It seems to me that there's been a proliferation lately of thoughtful examination on the left about how we communicate with a broader population. Why do you think this trend has asserted itself now, and why do you think it's important for social movements to develop new ways to explain our work and frame our messages?
Well, I think that's always been the essence of what social movements have done, is amplify the voices of people who are feeling the impacts of injustice and oppression, and to help people mobilize around a common vision of how things could be better. And in some ways, those historic qualities that have been so much a part of successful movement building around the world have been lost in many ways in the last generation here in the United States, where many organizations have either, for very good reasons, broken down into single-issue work or working in specific contexts. So I think a lot of those traditional movement-building skills haven't been updated for the current context we live in of 24-hour news cycles, of soundbite media, of sophisticated propaganda and corporate public relations. So I think there's been a lot of great work and a lot of soul searching that's been happening by people working to make change, particularly in the Bush years as well, because the Bush administration was so effective at manipulating the terms of the debate and at essentially lying to the American public in a very compelling way. And I think it forced a lot of people working for social justice, environmental sanity, for peace, to reassess some of our tactics and to innovate and bring new tools into the traditional social movement toolbox.
What, in your view, is the colonized imagination that you refer to in the title of your essay?
Well, speaking to folks in Hawaii, I'm sure there's people there obviously know a great deal about colonization.
Yes, that's right.
and how it operates. In this sense, but the reference is both to the history of European colonization, specifically around the world, that has shaped so much of the context here in North America, where so many of the problems that we're facing have such deep roots in the organized white supremacy of the European conquest, roots in industrial capitalism, roots in the separation between humanity and nature that's been perpetuated as part of those systems. But specifically, in addition to that, the idea that inspired this essay around the colonized imagination was around how we, a lot of times, folks, even folks who are working for social justice, folks who are working representing impacted communities, oftentimes our concepts and our vision of what's possible gets defined by the very systems that we're working to challenge. And oftentimes our very imagination gets limited in terms of what we're willing to be fighting for and working for. And the effort of the essay, and specifically using those concepts of colonization, was to put that in the context, the historical context that that's come from, and remind us that so many of the battles for freedom and for land and for a better future, so much of that work also has a significant component within our own minds, within our own imaginations, and making sure that we're taking the first step towards really changing the world, which is imagining truly different worlds and working towards them.
Can you think of a concrete example of one of the ways that we've allowed the colonizer, so to speak, to limit our imaginations and movements?
Well, to break down the we a little bit, there's lots of different folks, different communities with different histories working in different ways. But in terms of the audience that we were specifically writing for and working with, were a lot of the movements that were rising up, challenging corporate power, challenging militarism, challenging institutional racism. And the terms of the debate, oftentimes, if you look at folks who were sort of fighting corporate globalization and the efforts by new institutions like the World Trade Organization or older institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to create and justify the takeover of our economy, our culture, our political system by multinational corporations, folks were forced, who were challenging that from many different movements, who were challenging the impacts of free trade and economic globalization, a lot of times we were forced to work within the terms of that existing debate. So, for instance, that, you know, the concept that's very prevalent within global capitalism, that we have to have economic growth, that the economy always has to grow for there to be progress. Now, that's a very limiting definition of how we as human beings on this planet could organize ourselves and relate to one another, and has oftentimes been used as an excuse to justify some very destructive practices. Likewise, I think almost every social movement struggles against some of the ingrained assumptions that, that change really isn't possible, that in fact, you know, there is no alternative to what's going on, that if you want to make change, you need to ask the folks who are in charge politely to make change, which is a very misleading, deliberately misleading view of how social progress has happened, right? Where progress has always happened because people have organized themselves into social movements and put pressure on the institutions that have been preventing them having dignified workplaces, or preventing them having the right to vote, or preventing them having self-determination. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of examples what took our work, the work of the Smart Meme Strategy and Training Project, in the direction of looking at how narratives and the stories that we tell and are told to us are oftentimes a real form of power, and that we have to be very aware of whose stories we're believing, who's getting to tell the story of what's possible and what the problem is and what the solution is, that all of those are really important components of making a better world.
Mm. And so what you're talking about is the concept of a meme, right? Which mm-hmm. might be an unfamiliar term to many people. Can you explain that?
Yeah, let me break that down for folks. It's a kind of weird, geeky sounding word for a concept that everybody experiences all the time. The notion of a meme is just like a gene of the culture. The idea that there are viral sort of mind viruses, if you will, and it's just a way of looking at culture. It could be a slogan or a buzzword. It could be like the Nike slogan, just do it. It could be a symbol. It could be a ritual like shaking hands. But the idea is that if we want to transform culture, that we need to have a way of looking at culture that makes us realize that, that culture is changing all the time, and that culture is always a space that is contested. So memes, one of the ways that we like to think of memes is as the sort of packaging for stories, a capsule that allows a story to spread. For instance, you know, we can a lot of times in here on the mainland or in the continental United States, in the history books, folks learn that Columbus discovered America. Now that's a neat little package for a certain historical narrative. We could certainly change that verb in there. There's a lot of different ways to describe what Columbus did. You could say Columbus invaded America, or, you know, but the point is that that is a package that kind of invisibilizes certain people's stories and histories and kind of moves as a meme through the culture. So, you know, someone learns that in high school, they pass it on to their kids, they pass it on to folks, it starts to become the norm. So memes are just, you know, in this era of the internet and of television, memes are constantly flying every which way. Almost everything is a meme. The question is how powerful a meme is it? And I should say that social movements have always done this, you know, from no taxation without representation to si se puede to, I'm sure, all of the memes that movements are putting out in Hawaii, whether it's, you know, a raised fist to show people's dignity and power, or certain symbols that folks use. This ability to shape the culture has always been at the center of successful social movements.
Well, I'd like to get deeper into this. The construction of memes in a moment. But first, I want to kind of dig back into your essay a little bit. And one of the things that you bring up in your essay is you talk about the doomsday economy and global pathology as frames for the overarching challenges we face. And, you say in your essay that the 18th century political frameworks of left versus right no longer fully capture the political fault lines of our era. Can you explain what you're getting at here, what these concepts? Talk to us a little bit about your concept of the values crisis.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So in terms of the doomsday economy, that's a perfect example of an effort to create a meme. You know, there's lots of different critiques out there and lots of the ways that people talk about what's wrong with the world. But that term is specifically designed to get people looking at the balance or the out-of-balanceness of global corporate capitalism with the ecological underpinnings. so that essentially, you know, when we have a system like the current global corporate capitalist system that is based on unlimited economic growth, they're essentially chewing away and hacking at the web of life that sustains us all. And a lot of what is being presented as progress is being presented as a growing gross domestic product, is in fact the destruction of people's ways of lives, of the ecosystems that sustain us, of the cultural autonomy and the subsistence economies that are actually so vital to life on the planet. So that's what that idea is trying to get at, and that in fact that at the roots of so many of the problems that communities around the world are facing and are fighting against is a kind of pathological mind virus around it, that are the system that has grown up does not really have a future. It's very difficult to see how we could continue living in this fossil fuel addicted, resource intensive consumer model that has been presented as a great way to live. And I think this is, you know, obvious to most people on the planet, I think. But that speaks to some of the issues we were just talking about, some of the ways that stories are told to justify what's happening that kind of numb people or prevent people from believing there's an alternative. So one of the issues that's explored in the essay and is much further explored in the work of the Smart Meme Strategy and Training Project is how we can engage people's basic common sense life values, the values of that most people live their lives by, the preciousness of the natural world, the preciousness of their communities, of their children, of stewardship, of their cultural practices, of whatever it may be, how we can contrast that with the lack of meaningful values in some way that is at the root of the global corporate system that we're facing, that says that essentially money is the most valuable thing, and that it doesn't matter in the cases of most corporations who are being assessed on how much profit they created for their shareholders. The question isn't being asked at what price. What did that profit, where did it come from? Whose community was obliterated? What forest was cut down? Whose rivers were poisoned to make that so-called profit? So that's what some of those, some of those ideas were presented there in a way to name what I think is the common sense response by a lot of movements around the world who have been saying this for some time.
We're speaking with Patrick Rainsborough, who's the one of the co-founders of the Smart Meme Strategy and Training Project and the author of a very compelling essay titled Decolonizing the Revolutionary Imagination. We're discussing the ideas in that essay today, along with some of the work of the Smart Meme Project. It seems to me, Patrick, that what you just described rang a bell for me, and that is something that I hear often when the conversation turns to, a challenge to capitalism. That one of the things that comes up from the opposition is that, well, you can't really. There is no alternative. People are just greedy by nature. Mm-hmm. There's no way to get past that. That if there's a, if things are held in common, there, somebody will take more than their share, and somebody won't work as hard as other people, and this kind of this is a very, very powerful concept mm-hmm. that has sunk into our social, consciousness, right? So, and what occurs to me that's very interesting about that is that if I look around myself, I think that, 99.9% of my daily interactions are actually much more kind of informed by generosity, compassion, friendliness, openness, willingness, to engage. These kinds of things seem to be more present in our everyday lives, and yet we have a social and economic and political system that seems to be kind of geared towards rewarding self-centeredness and greed,
mm-hmm.
right? So I don't know if you could respond to that. I mean, it's just an observation that I've had, and I'm wondering how that plays into what you're saying.
I mean, absolutely. That's it's sort of that experience of running into those kind of deeply embedded assumptions is what led us to starting the Smart Meme Project, because we felt a lot of the work we were doing as organizers and as activists was, as you try to dig down to where a lot of these problems that so many people face are connected, it runs into these roots in some of these cultural assumptions, some of the ones that you were just describing. I mean, I think the modern system that we live in has done a great job of making people believe a fairly specific set of things about human nature that is, you know, completely without context in many ways, and in fact represents a very one-sided view of the story. I think a lot of histories of communities that were colonized and conquered and were living in very different ways has been obliterated and has simply been taken out of the story, and we're told that greed is good because it's okay in a contemporary context to give $700 billion last fall to the very same Wall Street bankers who destroyed the economy because somehow they're the experts that are going to fix it. You know, and there's all these self-perpetuating mythologies that move this forward, and I think that is the essence of what makes me hopeful about so many of the social movements around the world today, is that folks are challenging these assumptions and are willing to frame the issues that they work on and the community struggles that they're engaged in around this fundamental clash of values of, are we going to have a global society that celebrates dignity and life and diversity and hope, or are we going to continue down this path of a global economic system based on exploitation and extraction and oppression? And it's become pretty clear as capitalism hits the natural ecological limits of the planet that it can't continue on, and that if we can't change it in time and can't challenge some of the power holders that are on operating the gears of this global doomsday machine, then we have a very scary looking future. So I find that somewhat hopeful that so much that in some ways our current economic crisis and the clarity of global warming and climate destabilization are helping so many folks from all walks of life realize that something is deeply and truly wrong in the way that the dominant culture and the dominant economy is operating, that there's a lot of potential, I think, for change.
I wonder if you see that potential, again, just in the expression of, or maybe building kind of a way for the daily expression of these very life-affirming values that people exercise every day in their interactions to become kind of a force for political change, right? Is that kind of what you're getting at?
I think so. That's certainly my hope. You know, I mean, in some ways, the silver lining, perhaps, of the financial crisis is that it's forcing folks to really look around their communities and look at who's there and look what's going on and start to recognize that no one's going to be able to wave a magic wand and solve all these problems. Our future really relies in building the resilience of our communities and relocalizing our food production, our energy production. Lessons that, in fact, many peoples around the world, particularly traditional indigenous communities, have never lost these lessons, have lost the value of community and of culture and of localizing their economy. So I hope that we're entering a period where we can all be a lot more open-minded about borrowing ideas and adapting solutions to our local communities.
Hmm. Let me shift gears slightly. You know, one of the things that you criticize in your essay is a kind of self-righteous tone that emerges in activism at times. Can you give us an example of what you mean and talk about how you would build an alternative to that approach?
Yeah, one of the ways we often refer to that, some colleagues of ours came up with a great phrase called the story of the righteous few. How oftentimes, you know, folks that are organizing around an issue, say in the early days of opposing the invasion of Iraq, there was massive people power expressed on the streets. A lot of amazing things happened to try to prevent the U.S. from invading Iraq this most recent time in 2003. Unfortunately, we weren't able to stop it, and then there was a bit of a lull afterwards. It was a difficult time, or sort of a feeling that, oh, millions of people around the world marched, mobilized, even engaged in nonviolent direct actions and civil disobedience, and still weren't able to stop it. And in that period, you often, as people struggle to continue on with the organizing, sometimes, and what this is trying to name, the sort of self-righteous tone, the feeling that people are, that somehow by protesting or making a voice or somehow being in the minority, that you're more righteous than the other folks around you. And then, in fact, it becomes self-affirming that, you know, there's only a few people standing up for this issue, and that's because all the other folks are, you know, somehow silently agreeing, or folks who aren't eating organic food, so that means somehow that they're part of the problem. And a lot of times these kind of narrow views of what it means to be an activist or what it means to be involved in social change oftentimes come from activists from very privileged backgrounds who don't necessarily see the dynamics of the way poverty or classism might be affecting different communities or how racism might be playing out. So that was particularly one of the dynamics that we were trying to name in that, just that it's very different to be an individual who goes through a certain process of politicization and says, wow, I really don't like the society that I'm living in. I want to see some changes happen. I'm going to try to change my life, and I'm going to try to advocate to other people to change their life. That's a great thing. That's very important. But that's very different than a whole community that has a common experience of oppression, whether it be because there's coal under their land and a giant multinational coal company has come in to destroy their land, or because of institutional racism or colonialism. When a whole community has a common experience of that, they organize in a very different way. And that's just an important dynamic to flesh out. So that was where some of that language you're referring to was trying to get at that distinction.
Yes, and you know, in fact, just I'd like to get your take on this. Lately, I've been kind of noticing a certain tone, emergent tone, within the conversation about the global climate crisis. And it's something that I've started to refer to as apocalypse fetishism.
Uh-huh. And, I like that phrase.
Yeah, and what I'm observing, which I find unsettling, is an almost gleeful sort of hand-wringing glee, you know, about, you know, this huge collapse is going to happen, and the, you know, this is really going to show the gluttonous masses the error of their ways.
Right.
And you know, but I'm going to be okay because I've got my canned beans in the basement and my gun, you know, and I'm going to protect my
solar-powered guitar amp.
Yeah. I'm kind of worried about this because this seems to be very popular in certain circles. This approach to, I wonder if you would consider this the development of a new meme that might not be so positive.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
How would you respond to that?
Well, you know, I mean, I think in many ways the climate crisis and its growing visibility represents the ultimate symptom of the failings of the dominant culture. So, in fact, in Sorin's most recent publication, one of the ways we talk about it is the slow motion apocalypse. And by apocalypse there, we don't necessarily mean the end of the world. We're actually referring to the origins of the term, what it means. The original Greek word means the lifting of the veil. So it's because of the Christian narrative, you know, it's John's apocalypse, the book of Revelations, the final book of the Bible, the definition of apocalypse has shifted from a revelation to the end of the world, because that's what that particular Christian revelation happened to be about. And I think it's actually very profound to look at this period as a slow-motion apocalypse, as a time when the veil is increasingly being lifted for more and more people, and they're realizing that the system that they live in is out of whack with their values and is increasingly not working and not serving them. And global warming is an incredible feedback loop for that. So I think people respond to that in very, very different ways. That can be a very dangerous period when the mythologies that have maintained the status quo collapse. It can lead to all sorts of horrible things. It can lead to people moving more into a politics of fear and taking out their fear on the historic divisions in our society, whether it's, you know, divisions of culture or divisions of race or divisions of gender. So that's a little scary, and I think a lot of ways that people are responding to the climate crisis feed into the dominant culture's sort of stories of individualism. You know, we've really been encouraged to think of ourselves as individual consumers and to think of solutions as either being provided by a corporation who's going to sell us a product or a politician who is going to somehow save us, as opposed to looking at the way that human beings have traditionally solved their problems, which is to get together with their neighbors and talk about what they're going to do about it.
Right.
So I think there is, I think there's just incredible shifts that are happening as people grapple with the ecological crisis as it starts to ripple through people's understanding of the world. And the specific instance or specific phenomenon you're talking about of the kind of apocalyptic glee, I think that I have also experienced that. I mean, you can look at something like Y2K,
right,
the phenomenon at the turn of the millennium, which was this perfect story that popped up. If you were a person who had a critique of capitalism and technology, this just sounded like the perfect kind of like I told you so story of like, oh, because of the stupidity of the way they design computers, the entire system and economy is going to collapse. And so many people bought into that because I think they wanted to believe that it was going to collapse. And of course, there's a great deal of marketing around that survivalism.
Sure.
So, you know, I think these are examples of ways when social movements and organized communities aren't putting out a strong enough vision of a positive alternative, a lot of times people get dragged into the undertow or the shadow side of the dominant culture. And the best you can do to imagine change is just to imagine it all blowing up or it all falling apart.
That's very interesting. I've kind of often wondered how much the kind of internet culture has led it, you know, kind of encouraged that in some ways. I think that's a conversation I'd like to have at another
mm-hmm.
time. But, you know, that people kind of looking into this, into these social a phenomenon from a very isolated place in front of a computer screen, and before you know it, they're kind of going down all these rabbit holes, and
mm-hmm.
then somebody who would be, you know, you might normally think is going to be a very, you know, kind of engaged social movement activist is talking about, you know, going down and becoming a member of the what do you call it, those guys at the border, the Minutemen or something,
right,
like that, you know, that kind of stuff. Like all these trends sort of get kind of balled together, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've got to remind my listeners, we're speaking with Patrick Rainsborough of the Smart Meme Strategy and Training Project, and we're talking about the use of developing ideas and values and constructs to help our social movements reach a broader, more mass population. I suppose that's a kind of awkward way of putting it, but in any case, we're going to take a very quick break for station ID, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to KACR on KAQA Kilowatt. This is Out of the Box.
All right. Okay. Well, I guess we didn't have any other announcements that needed to be made right then. So we are speaking with Patrick Rainsborough. Thank you for your patience. Why don't we talk a little bit about direct action, because this is what, you know, really what it's all about, right? You address the use of direct action at various what you call points of intervention. Can you explain this for us?
Sure. You know, in terms of looking at direct action is both, you know, maybe used by a community as a tactic within a struggle, or it may be a whole political ethos that people have around our community is going to do things for ourselves. Our community is going to, if there's a problem that has to be solved, we're going to fix it ourselves. So I think that ethic has always been at the center of how progress has been made in society as people organize and challenge injustice. So points of intervention is just a way of to help people strategize when they're looking at a problem that they're working to solve. Say it's that your community is, they're scheduling or they're promoting putting a big toxic waste dump in your community, and you know that what this is going to mean in terms of contaminating the local environment, raising the disease rates, poisoning your children, all the things that come with that. And you're trying to figure out how to stop this injustice from happening and how to shift the events in a more positive direction. A point of intervention is merely a place where you can intervene in a system. So traditionally, places where movements have intervened, like the point of production. You know, when workers in this country were wanted to organize into unions and get better conditions, they organized in the factories at the point of production, and they took them over. They might have gone on strike or have occupied, sat down where in the factory and refused to leave until they got better wages and better conditions. This is why we don't have children working, or why it's illegal for children to work, or why we have weekends or the eight-hour day, is not because some benign industrialist decided that would be a good way to do things, but instead because everyday working people organized themselves and struggled and died to win those concessions from their bosses. So that's an example of the point of production. Lots of other places where movements intervene includes, you know, maybe the point of destruction. Where are the natural resources that are happening, that are being used in the factory? Where are they coming from? You know, maybe it's a logging company that's pushing into indigenous lands in the Amazon that's cutting down the trees. Maybe it's a mining company in Indonesia. So around the world, particularly in the world's remaining indigenous homelands, there are communities standing up preventing resource extraction. Maybe the point of destruction in your community is the pipe where they dump the toxic contamination upstream from your village. So that's just a notion of what these kind of points can look like. Point of production, point of destruction. We also have found it very useful in our work to talk about the point of decision, which is where decision makers might be. That could be the local slumlord, or it could be your local representative, or it could be the CEO of a corporation. And also looking at the point of consumption. A lot of great work has happened in the last generation around campaigns in the marketplace about putting pressure on a company or even a government by where they're selling their products. So if you think about all the work that's happened to challenge sweatshops, where people will target a company that's selling sweatshop clothes. So the point of consumption is wherever people are buying those products, and you can reach out to the folks and say, hey, you need to understand when you're buying this product, you're supporting slavery, or you're supporting the destruction of the forest. Mm-hmm. So those are just some examples of traditional points of intervention, and where that model, what that, for us, that work around naming that model, again, those are all the historic places. There's nothing new about acknowledging that that's where people have struggled. But for us, what was interesting is that kind of created the scaffolding, if you will, for us to climb into looking at social change in a different way, of looking at how can we change the culture or the narratives or the common understanding around issues. And, of course, that's what always happens ultimately in any struggle. Part of the process of unionizing the factory or ending slavery or, you know, winning Dolphin Safe Tuna, whatever it may be, part of that process of making the physical changes in policies and institutions is changing the cultural stories around it, is changing the way people understand an issue. And so that, for us, is one of where a lot of our work is focused, is on a point of intervention that we refer to as the point of assumption. What are the assumptions that people have that are allowing this injustice to happen, and how can we be more specific and intentional about targeting those assumptions and surfacing them and showing when an assumption is based on lies or injustice, and creating from that a momentum for positive change?
I hope you have a few more minutes that you can share with us, Patrick.
Sure, my pleasure.
I'd like to open the phone line up to any listeners in the community who might have questions, comments, or ideas to share with you. The number to call in is 826-7771. If you're off-island, you can call the toll-free number at 866-275-1112. While we're waiting for calls, I ask you to maybe start. Oh, looks like we do have a call right now, so we'll go to that. Okay, caller?
Hi there.
Hi. Go ahead and make your comment or ask your question.
Great, thanks for the show. Yeah, you have some great wisdom on all of the intense things going on the Earth. I'm wondering if you're up to date on this whole what's being looked at as a financial crisis and, you know, these hundreds of billions of dollars going to these bankers and things like this, and if you can give it some, if you have ideas for a practical solution of what can be done to transmute out of that old system of the U.S. dollar.
Thank you, caller. We'll just...
Let's listen off air.
Okay, thank you. All right, Patrick, would you like to respond to that?
Great. Thank you so much for the question. You know, I wish that I had easy answers for it, but a general comment about it, you know, we've seen just in the last days, another massive... a massive government bailout was passed. Theoretically, this one is going to be a bailout for ordinary people, and it's going to help us with ordinary people dealing with the economic crisis. And I think it's really important for us to, while simultaneously working with policymakers to make sure that this money is getting into the hands of communities that really need it, to be challenging the trajectory of where a lot of our current understanding of the economy is going. You know, a lot of great work is happening about people bringing back the idea of the New Deal, what Franklin Roosevelt did in responding to the Great Depression in the 30s, but trying to make sure that if there is a New Deal, that it's a so-called Green New Deal, and making sure that we're quite critical that these investments don't just go towards the current traditional industries, but rather go towards the values that people really want. So if we're going to be putting people back to work, are we going to be putting people back to work making cheap disposable plastic crap, or are we going to put them back to work putting solar panels on people's houses? You know, I think these are really relevant questions that a lot of folks are struggling with. And it's a very difficult terrain because economics is kind of the ultimate control mythology, if you will. It's sort of like, oh, this is very complicated. You couldn't possibly understand. We've brought in our magic economists to tell us how to do this. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the most important myths for us to challenge, the fact that economics is not, in fact, a science. Economics is largely shaped by ideology, and that the issues that are at play in these economic discussions are fundamentally the issues of democracy, and they're issues that deserve to be debated and surfaced and be transparent in all of our communities. And to start turning some of that, the momentum that's out there in the culture around we're in this period of crisis, which oftentimes that's used to tell people to shut up and just go along with whatever the government says, I think there's a lot of opportunity for community organizers and activists to turn that around in terms of deepening people's understanding of what the crisis is that we're in and start creating local and appropriate solutions.
We're speaking with Patrick Greensboro of the Smart Meme Project. We're discussing many things, including his essay, Decolonizing the Revolutionary Imagination. And we're taking your calls at 826-7771 or 866-275-1112. And we do have another call. Hello, caller.
Hi, thank you. I'm curious, guest, have you come across any of the writings of Robert Putnam or Mancur Olson or anyone along those lines?
I have not, but those sound fascinating.
Okay. I thought that you might have. And that question just popped up. But my original one was, with respect to lessening the value that different persons or societies put on money as something to just be, you know, chase after through all costs. I'm curious, when that concept is discussed, what else is discussed along the lines of simultaneously maintaining the values of things like innovation, productivity, efficiency? In other words, capitalism or money is one of the tools that helps that along, and I'm certainly not suggesting that's the only way to do that. And I'm curious if, well, that was my question. Should I expand on it, or?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's a great question because it gets to a lot of issues, which is that there's a lot of things that our current economic and cultural system does very well. You know, as you point out, in terms of, you know, driving innovation, efficiency, some of these things, it may or may not do it well, but these are really important qualities. And, you know, I think the biggest issue in some ways for reframing the way that we talk about economics is we're still oftentimes, at least for anyone who's trying to criticize the status quo, oftentimes the debate gets sort of locked in this Cold War era dichotomy that, oh, if you're criticizing anything about capitalism, it must be that you're promoting this vision of communism that we all saw didn't work in the Soviet Union and et cetera, rather than sort of breaking down the larger issue, which is that there's an incredible amount of models and different ways that communities can organize themselves, and that a lot of the reasons that are, you know, a lot of the of our policies on a national and international level are more about consolidating power and control and centralization than they are actually meeting human needs. And so if we can try to break that down a little bit and say, you know, there's lots of different ways that folks can organize themselves, there's lots of solutions to this problem, and try to borrow and adapt from a lot of places, you know, I certainly personally don't have, and nor is it my place to have, some sweeping alternative to our current economic system. But fortunately, I think there are literally millions of people in communities all around the world who are starting to innovate and figure out ways to relocalize their economy, reorient it. So I don't know if that really answered your question, but in terms of the comment you're raising, it is really important that I think even what you said about, you know, understanding if we're challenging the, you know, the whole pursuit that money is the only value, it's really important for us to understand that money is, in fact, just a tool, and we may want to use money in different ways. Communities may want to create their own currencies, for instance, was a big strategy in the Great Depression in the United States for folks to have control and relocalize their community. So,
thank you. We have another call. Hang on just a second.
Hello.
Hi, caller. You're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to. There were a couple of things. Number one, I couldn't quite catch the name of it. It's called Smart Means, M-E-A-N-S.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I should have spelled that because it is kind of an unusual word. It's Smart, M-E-M-E.
M-E-M-E.
Yeah, and there's a website at smartmeme.org.
.org. Okay,
yeah.
And the name of the fellow that's speaking that I'm going to speak to?
Yes, this is Patrick Rainsborough that you'll be speaking to.
Patrick Rain, R-A-I-N?
R-E-I-N-S.
Rainsborough.
Yeah, B-R-O-U-G-H.
Okay, that's good. Thanks.
No problem, and go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I had to get that information written down because I'm so much in line with what you're speaking of, and it has to do with the language that we speak. And we are in the habit of speaking in language that comes from a place that we're no longer at.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you had read, I wanted to recommend a couple of books that go along with some of the things you're talking about. One of them is called The Ecology of Freedom by Murray Bushkin.
Uh-huh.
And he talks about the evolution of cultural ideas that are not necessarily true, and that we're free all the way along, and we've been making choices that have led us to this place, but it doesn't mean it's human nature,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, and so on and so forth, which I heard you talking about. And then the other book I thought was quite interesting was a book called The Green Alternative, which talks about alternative methods of gathering together our resources in smaller communities, making us whole communities, trading with one another, and it's a very interesting approach to economics. That's two things. And then the third thing I wanted to really ask you was, what are you doing to be in touch with the economists in the Obama administration? Because what you're talking about is really important, and it would be interesting if they were to form some kind of a cabinet-level person who would be in charge of a study or a continuous study of means and effects, you know, the ways and means in which we are affecting our larger picture through the kind of economics that we do. And like you were saying, as you were saying in this one instance where you're talking about it, I can't remember it, but it was something about, you know, if people cut down trees, how does it affect the water? You know, and that's, you know, the overall management of the economy in a physical sense.
Mm-hmm.
Are you in touch with that Obama administration, which is the current administration? Are you doing anything to further your information in their direction and to encourage possibly a cabinet position?
Well, thank you, caller. I'm going to let let Patrick answer that
okay.
with you off
I'm
the
off.
Air so we can open
okay.
the phone.
Great.
Line.
Right on.
Thank you.
Right.
Yeah, thanks for the and thanks for the book references. Murray Bookchin and the whole approach of social ecology that he created has actually been a really big influence on us. So I really appreciate you shouting that out for folks, because there's a lot of great thinking in that area. In terms of being in touch with the Obama administration, we are not in touch with the Obama administration personally, although lots of great folks are. And although I certainly don't want to do anything to diminish the significance and the pride that I think people all over the country, and I bet particularly in Hawaii, are taking in Obama, I'd have to say that on the economic crisis sort of front, there's very little that he is doing that appears to me to be at the scale of the crisis. I mean, we've been talking here about some of the assumptions and underlying cultural narratives that inform and set and the terms of the debate around the economy, and in many ways the elephants in the room are so big that the whole field of economics, by that I mean neoclassical economics, doesn't really even touch them. You know, where you've got a situation that, as the slogan goes, economists simply need to learn to subtract. They need to understand that not all economic activity is positive, and that basically we have this deep accounting perversion at the root of our modern global system where, you know, whether you're a divorce or a cancer patient or a toxic chemical spill, that is all positive economic activity. And now, in real life, outside the fantasy world of economics and their models, we know that a lot of things that happen, like a toxic waste spill, are not good. Even though maybe some folks will get a job cleaning it up, or there'll be a company that does that, or maybe it saved some money for the chemical company because they cut some corners, that's not positive economic activity. And at its roots, the economy, and even looking at the economy as the dominant system on the planet, which is often how it's talked about, is very, very misleading, because the economy is a subsystem of a far more profound and important system, which is the natural world, right? I mean, that's what the economy is based on. And in fact, in the last generation, this period that, according to the economists, of unprecedented economic growth, when we've seen the value of the global economy literally grow by 10, 12 times over the last generation, what we've really seen is the liquidation of the life support systems of the planet. The disruption of the climate, the clear-cutting of our forests, the strip mining of valuable resources, and in fact that this is getting to a real crisis point that we're seeing, and that it's essential that economists learn to put the eco back in economy, that we have to learn that we cannot continue to be constantly borrowing from the natural capital and destroying it in order to make money. Instead, we have to learn how to make our economy work in balance with the natural systems and make a sort of grand U-turn, if you will, in the dominant economic thinking from an economy that's based on extraction of natural wealth to an economy that's based on restoration of natural wealth. So I certainly don't want to sell Obama short. He's a very, very intelligent man, and maybe he'll start moving us in that direction. But based on the folks that he is appointing to office and the way that the economy continues to be talked about, I think that's a problem we're all going to have to take on. We're all going to have to be working to re-educate our representatives and to re-educate ourselves and our communities. Fortunately, there is, I think, a growing understanding of ecological economics and a growing understanding of that we need to move towards a so-called steady state economy, an economy that's not based on constantly growing and constantly using more natural resources, because the planet simply can't sustain it.
We have another call. All right, caller, you're on the air. Hi.
Oh, hey, thanks. I wanted to bring up this subject that kind of disturbs me, and that's large religious organizations such as the Catholic Church seem to be just fine with the people at the top bathe in gold and the people at the bottom suffering and living needs, even their own flock. And here's the head of the church, of the Catholic Church. He's an ex-Nazi. He's sitting up in a place called St. Peter's, named after a man that betrayed Jesus, doing his rituals in the language of people that killed Jesus. And I saw him on TV blessing exotic sports cars, and he's also wearing gold finery, and his own people are suffering. And this is religion. These are the people that are supposed to care. So what I'm saying is I've never been able to get that, and if religion can keep on propagating these ideas, it's okay for somebody to sell a mountain of gold and the other person to be destitute and starving. What hope do we have for non-religious institutions when even our religious institutions are so corrupt, you know?
Hmm. Interesting question.
Fall off the air.
Yeah, thank you. All right, Patrick?
Great. Well, thanks for bringing that up. Again, not necessarily an issue that I really have an answer for you on, but, you know, I do take some hopefulness in the fact that I think organized religion in some ways is losing its grasp on the larger issue of spirituality. And I take some consolation in the fact that there are many, many different religions on the planet, many different perspectives, some big, some small. I think in the case of the Catholic Church, you know, in almost any giant global institution, there's a tendency for hierarchy to sort of pervert the mission, if you will. So, I mean, no disrespect to Catholics are out there living, but I think out there listening. But I think the Catholic Church is a perfect example. If a simple reform in the Catholic Church, who is one of the largest landowners on the planet, I should mention, if the Catholic Church was to take their investment portfolio and to ensure that they only invested it based on even something as simple as the Ten Commandments, say, that could lead to some pretty dramatic changes in our global economic system. For instance, if you say, well, you know, let's get all the money out of the war industry. Let's get all the money out of the toxic chemical industry. You know, so I think there is, and I do want to say that just speaking within Christianity, I think there is very positive trends that are happening of folks within that specific spiritual tradition, as within other religions, who are starting to step up and grapple with some of these issues. And I know within the debate around stewardship versus dominion within Christianity, in terms of what is the relationship between humanity and the planet, whereas it's traditionally been a definition of dominion, that the earth belongs to humans to trash as they will, versus humans as steward, which seems to be an emerging kind of movement within a wing of Christianity that's really stepping up to talk about global warming and to talk about justice. So I think within every at least within some of the big spiritual traditions, there's a lot of different trends. For every, you know, for every person at the top who's abusing their position of system, their position in the hierarchy, I think there's probably folks in other parts who are doing, you know, great work. In this case, I'm thinking of folks, the liberation theology movement all around Latin America, or the work that's being done by everyday parish priests or other practitioners of faith in their community to heal people and bring people together. But always a challenge dealing with any big hierarchy, whether it's religious, political, cultural. Right. They tend to be a little unresponsive.
You know, Patrick, I wanted to, there's so much more that I wanted to talk to you about, and I'm sure there's so much more that the listeners wanted to ask you, but we are running up against our next segment. And I just, before we break and go to our next guest, Lena Sullivan from Kahana Valley and on Oahu, I wanted to just refocus again, let people know, if you can, how to access some of the materials that are available through Smart Meme. You know, some of the, I know that Smart Meme just recently published a new, a very beautiful manual that I'd like you to talk about a little bit, and just give some contact information if they want to learn more.
Sure. So So Smart Meme, as we said, is a strategy and training project and an online resource. So folks who have access to the internet can check us out online at www.smartmeme.org. That's smartmeme.org. And you will find all sorts of different resources and things there, including the new book that we've just published called Reimagining Change, An Introduction to Story-Based Strategy. And this is a resource guide for activists and organizers who want to work on changing the stories in their own communities and to apply grassroots movement building with strategies to shift the culture. So that's what that is a resource guide for. You can also find on there, it's available, you can order the book online from there, or you can get it as a free download off our website. There's also, you can download the essay that we've been talking about some here, which is Decolonizing the Revolutionary Imagination. And I should add that that essay is published in a fantastic book that I would really recommend to folks. It's a book called Globalized Liberation, How to Uproot the System and Build a Better World, edited by David Solnit. And the essay we've been talking about is just one of many incredible essays in there. It's a compilation that we at Smart Meme are honored to be a part of, including voices from around North America, lots of creative ideas ranging from farm worker organizing in Florida to tenants' rights struggles in Toronto to indigenous struggles in Colombia. It's got an incredible, it's kind of a... kind of like a travel guide to social movements and collective liberation. So I really recommend that one. You can order that one online. It came out a few years ago from City Lights Press, so people can get it through most online booksellers or so. And then you can reach Smart Meme through our website at www.smartmeme.org. And I just want to send a shout out to everyone who's doing all the amazing work that's happening in Hawaii, working for indigenous sovereignty and demilitarization and working to stop the spread of genetic contamination and all the other social justice issues that are going on out there. I constantly hear stories coming from Hawaii, and we are inspired from them and learning from all the work you're all doing out there. So,
well, thank you. That's very nice to hear, and I look forward to strengthening links between the struggles here and the struggles there in the future. And in closing, I just wanted to kind of let people know that you end your essay with a wonderful quote from the slogan from Paris in 1968. Do you want to just say what that quote is?
Yes. So for folks who don't know, in 68, the kind of the various uprisings that were happening around the world, very, very exciting time and valuable, and something that we always try to remember, a slogan that was spray-painted there, be realistic, demand the impossible.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much, Patrick. We've been speaking with Patrick Greensboro of the Smart Meme Project and also, a former organizing director for Rainforest Action Network, and plenty of information there in that essay. I really encourage people to check it out. So our next segment, we'll be speaking to Lena Sullivan. I'm sorry, after we get back from our station ID.
You're listening to KKCR Honolulu, KAQA, Kilauea, 90.9 Honolulu, 91.9 on all other shores except Anahola and Molokai. You can tune in at 92.7. This program is supported in part by Rico Business Solutions and Pacific Tile.
Rico Business Solutions. Sales and service on Kauai. Digital black and white and color systems, complete with copy, print, scan, and fax from networks or standalone PCs. Rico Business Solutions, 246-9531, formerly Linear Worldwide.
Pacific Tile, offering creative ideas on tile and stone with knowledgeable consultants located at Lihue at 245-1765 or on the web at pacific-tile.com.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, board, volunteers, or underwriters.
Mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. This is Out of the Box, and we'll be back in a second.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I haven't heard from Lena Sullivan yet. I'm expecting her to call in. She's going to bring some new information about the struggle at Kahana Valley on Oahu, on Windward Oahu, where several Native Hawaiian families are resisting an eviction by the state DLNR. But since we haven't been able to get a hold of her, hopefully she'll call in while we're talking. We will open the phone lines for your questions, comments, and ideas at 826-7771, and we do have a caller on the line. Hello, caller.
Aloha. I have a quick announcement.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a website for people, anyone who's interested in an upcoming permaculture course here on Kauai, and it'll be the end of March and beginning of April, and the website to check out is Activate.